Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin today with state politics and Beacon Hill's legislative agenda for the new year. Among the top issues lawmakers are expected to take on in the coming months, a push for a higher minimum wage, how to slow galloping health care costs, how to reform the criminal justice system. And despite the state's strong economy, they'll face a budget gap and difficult choices on spending. Joshua Miller covers politics for the Boston Globe and has his finger on the Beacon Hill pulse and joins us now. Welcome, Joshua. Good to have you.
So glad to be with you, Anthony.
And happy New Year.
And to you.
So let's begin with marijuana, which voters legalized for recreational use in November. Legislators delayed the opening date for recreational marijuana stores by 6 months. So what are the main issues that lawmakers need to work out here?
Yeah, there's a lot they're going to be addressing going forward in these next few months, and they'll be doing it quickly because the time is limited. Now, to begin, proponents who wrote the measure, which passed with about 1.8 million votes, say it is a comprehensive, implementable law that will protect public health and safety and has already ended more than 100 years of failed prohibition. Indeed, possessing and using marijuana became legal on December 15th. But legislative leaders think it has some big holes. First, as you said, they expanded the time frame, so recreational pot shops aren't expected to open until July of 2018, and they said that was to give them more time to make so-called fixes to the law and make new laws to complement it. One of the first big items I suspect they'll address is about driving high on marijuana. Mm-hmm. Now, that's already illegal, but there's no bright-line standard like there is for alcohol, so if you have a blood alcohol level of 0.08 or more, you're driving drunk. There's no metric like that for marijuana, for THC, the main psychoactive chemical in marijuana, and that, cops say, can make policing high driving really tough. One other area is edibles, those pot-infused candies, cookies, savory treats that make up a big chunk of the recreational market in states like Colorado and Washington. And there's a lot of worry from policymakers that manufacturers here might sell edibles that are attractive to kids, or that have so much THC, that psychoactive pot chemical in them, that it makes people sick and they don't know how much they're getting.
I see. So some stuff to work out there. I want to move on and talk about the minimum wage. As of January 1st, the state's minimum wage went up to $11 an hour. That's the final raise from a law passed in 2014. But as you reported today, there's a move to push it up to $15. What are the arguments in favor, and how do you expect this to play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think advocates say that $11 an hour is a good sort of first step in creating more equality of incomes, but it's not enough to live on. And a living wage would really be looking at something more like a minimum wage of $15 an hour. And the same advocates who tirelessly pushed for the raise to $11 an hour are sort of expected to be doing something towards $15 an hour this legislative session. And they've already threatened that if lawmakers don't act, they'll go to the ballot and pass it through the people. Obviously, business groups are really concerned about that, and they say if they have to pay everyone more, it's going to simply mean, especially in businesses that hire a lot of minimum wage people, they're just going to be able to hire fewer people, and that'll mean higher unemployment and some people who don't have any access to an income.
All right, so familiar debate there. Let's move on and talk about health care spending. It continues to increase. The legislature passed a law a while back to try to put the brakes on the rise of health care costs. It has increased more in the last 2 years than legislators wanted. What are lawmakers proposing to do now?
Well, there are a lot of different ways to go at it, and it'll be interesting to see which ones they take up. They haven't given a lot of details, but I think there's an acknowledgement that given that per capita health spending in the state increased 4.2% in 2014, about the same in 2015, it's not really a sustainable rise because inflation is so much less than that, and healthcare costs eat up more and more of the state budget as a percentage every year. So I think they might try to go back to the drawing board and see how they can work off that law they passed a few years ago to try to rein in those healthcare costs. But the specifics of it really are TBD.
When we talk about legislative agendas, it's all about spending. And I want to ask you about this, about the state budget. I mean, this is a state, as you pointed out this morning in the Globe, that enjoys a pretty strong economy, low unemployment. And yet the state continues to deal with one budget gap after another, requiring Governor Baker to impose three rounds of emergency budget cuts since he took office in 2015. There's a new fiscal year coming up in the summer. What accounts for these budget gaps, and do we expect another one, and how are legislators going to respond to that?
Anthony, all depends on your view and the people's view. Liberals say the reason that we keep facing these budget gaps is there's simply not enough revenue. There's not enough money to pay for the services that Massachusetts people want. They point to tax cuts imposed by voters by a referendum in 2000 and several other tax cuts along the way. But conservatives say, you know, Massachusetts has a bloated bureaucracy with tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of employees. It could be cut down to size, and we don't need to raise taxes. We need to just rein in government spending. Now, another issue, whether you're conservative or liberal, another issue that definitely has played a role in this is those health care costs. Medicaid, the joint federal-state health care program for the poor, has eaten up more and more and more of the budget in every year, sort of going back all the way 10, 20, 30 years. So there's less and less room to spend on other things. But whatever the reason is for these budget gaps, that's something legislators and Governor Charlie Baker are going to have to address in the months ahead, definitely.
Well, one last question, and it's about Governor Charlie Baker. He's halfway through his first term. Polls show he's enormously popular. He has a great working relationship with the Democratic leaders on Beacon Hill. What do you foresee in the months ahead? I mean, he could be gearing up for re-election soon enough. I mean, is that kind of congenial attitude up there on Beacon Hill likely to survive? What's your view?
I think it's very likely to survive. I think it's to his benefit and to the benefit of the Democratic House Speaker, Bob DeLeo, and the Democratic Senate President, Stan Rosenberg, to keep a working relationship. Whether it is to the benefit of the Democratic Party overall is a broader question. It'll be interesting to see, especially next year when Baker's expected to be facing voters in November of 2018, whether the relationship breaks down a little bit. But for now, they've all had kind words for each other. They've worked together on big pieces of legislation, like the one addressing the opioid crisis. And I expect that to continue definitely in the beginning months of this year. We'll see how it unfolds as the election grows nearer and nearer.
Well, we'll see how it unfolds, and we always appreciate doing that with you. That's Joshua Miller. He covers politics for the Boston Globe, talking about the legislative agenda for the coming months. Joshua, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We've been reaching out to state leaders to hear about their priorities on key issues over the next 2 years. So we're joined now by Senate President Stan Rosenberg, who just won re-election earlier today. And Mr. Senate President, welcome to Radio Boston, and congratulations on your re-election.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you. So you outlined some of your legislative agenda today. What's on top of your list? What's your top priority?
So I would say education, transportation, criminal justice reform, and continuing to modernize the operations of the legislature so we can get legislation, quality legislation, done more quickly. I tried to point out that, as happened with Uber and Lyft, where for about 5 years they were unregulated in the state, and then we did regulation, and that was after taxis had been in place and regulated in this Commonwealth for probably 100 years or more. And so their regulation and their government involvement evolved over literally generations, where Uber sprung upon the scene, and within 4 or 5 years we had to do regulation, and we did it. And the ink is barely dry on the legislation, and now we have autonomous vehicles through which Uber and Lyft are likely to be sending you driverless cars instead of an Uber with a driver in it to pick you up. So, and we're going to have to come up with rules and regulations and law around that, and it's going to open up a whole series of public policy questions around liability and insurance and transportation finance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, literally, in less than 10 years, we will have visited two disruptive technologies related to demand response transportation, where in the 100 years before that, we had a pretty stable system that had developed over time and sort of managed to sort of be pretty much the same for most of that time.
It sounds like that really requires a different way of thinking for you lawmakers.
Totally does. We have to have a longer-term vision, and we have to move more quickly. And we have to be prepared to not kick the can down the road, but to pick up the challenges and move with them more quickly. And it's not limited to these technology pieces. Education, we haven't made we did a 20-year education reform plan in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, and it worked very well, but we're in a new time. And we haven't made a multi-year commitment to a vision for public education and funding. in decades.
Let me ask you about education. With relationship to this, voters defeated question two quite soundly. That would have greatly expanded the number of charter schools in the state. You said that that signaled the need for education 2.0, which would focus on all kids. So what does that look like?
Correct.
What is education 2.0?
2.0 looks like a multi-year commitment for education finance for all of the children, not just the 4 or 5% of the children who are in charter schools and maybe 7 or 8% that might be in charter schools a decade from now. So we need to look at all of the children. We've also got to continue to modernize, and we've got to have universal childhood early childhood education. Doesn't all have to be paid for by the government, but for income-eligible families, there's 26,000 kids on a waiting list. Those kids, if they get into early childhood education and that's successful, they have a better chance of reading at grade level by the fourth grade than if they don't have that help and opportunity. And if they succeed in reading at grade level by the fourth grade, their chances of success in the rest of their education skyrocket. And so it's that kind of long-term thinking that went on in the early 90s when we made a multi-year commitment to pretty much double public funding for education over a seven-year period, and we kept that promise, but we stalled, and we've got to get back on track.
Well, last year's Senate measure on education didn't get a vote in the House. Given the defeat, following the defeat of question two, why would this year be any different in terms of getting a compromise through the full legislature?
We have a responsibility to look to the future and make sure that we're addressing two of the fundamental pillars of our economy, which is an educated workforce and a transportation system that supports getting goods and people to where they need to be as efficiently as possible, and preferably in a way that reduces our carbon footprint and our impact on climate change. So all of those things blend together, and there is an opportunity for the voters to push us in this direction, if you will, because if the fair share tax plan is approved by the voters in 2018, when it appears on the ballot, they will provide the wherewithal for us to be able to fund a robust multi-year commitment for pre-K through higher ed, as well as for transportation improvements.
Now, fair share tax plan, for our listeners who might not be up to date, remind us what that is. That would be a tax on millionaires, correct?
It would be a tax on millionaires, similar to what was done in California, one of our most one of the states we compete against most for companies and for investment in high tech and life sciences, et cetera. So they've made a very strong commitment to making sure that they have the revenue they need to support education and other governmental programs that support the economy. Every business person I talk to talks to me about four things, and some combination of the four: education, transportation, affordable housing, and filling the skills gap, because there's 100,000 jobs sitting vacant on any given day and 100,000 people unemployed. Because there's a mismatch between their skills and the openings, the jobs stay vacant and the people stay unemployed.
Mm. So let me ask you about an issue that's somewhat related to this, and that is the effort to further raise the minimum wage. You were key to increasing it to $11 an hour, which went into effect just 3 days ago. Massachusetts now has the highest minimum wage in the country. Several unions and community groups are pushing for a $15 minimum wage. Do you think that's feasible for Massachusetts?
A number of other states have already adopted a $15 minimum wage going out 3 or 4 years. New York and California would be two examples of that. So, again, the states with which we compete the most are recognizing that if you don't put enough money into the paychecks of the workers, they don't have the income to spend and to support their small businesses, et cetera, which helps with the economy, but it also has them struggling to pay their own bills, in which case they have to turn to the government for fuel and food and rental and health care assistance, all of which is then passed on to other taxpayers in order to subsidize. So this is a matter of coming up with a rational, thoughtful plan to gradually increase so that a minimum wage becomes gets high enough to be a truly livable wage and people can stop having to turn to the government for programs and services to supplement their income because they go to work, sometimes two and three jobs, work 50, 60, 70 hours a week, and they still don't make enough money to support their family.
Yeah, I know. It's a huge challenge, clearly, for families. But what do you say to the businesses who say that a higher minimum wage forces them to hold off on hiring or consider moving altogether to states where the minimum wage would be lower?
So most of the states where they'd want to move are also looking at increasing the minimum wage. Oh. And it's really a question of doing this carefully and gradually, as we just did moving to $11 an hour. We did that a dollar a year over 3 years. Businesses were able to plan. And yes, there can be, and there isn't always, but there can be some small dislocation in the economy during that transition. But it's usually when you have that first increment, because the other two increments in this case, they could plan for and they could adjust and adjust their operating budgets and their operating and their strategies to be able to accommodate what is they were going to need to do. You know, we have the third highest per capita income in the country here in Massachusetts, a very high quality and standard of living, and this is the kind of place you want to live in. The kinds of places that a lot of people say they would move to, they wouldn't actually move in the end because they would not want to live there and run their businesses there. They won't want to raise their families there, et cetera. So this is about the government working cooperatively with the business community, coming up with sensible strategy to be able to phase this in carefully and appropriately so that we cause the minimum of dislocation. And remember, every dollar that goes into somebody's paycheck, if you're making $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year, goes right back into the economy.
I want to ask you a sort of more general question about the nature of governing these days in Massachusetts. And unlike lawmakers in Washington, D.C., Massachusetts has been notable for the way Democrats, like you, in the legislature work with a Republican governor. Do you expect that to continue this year? Because Baker could well be gearing up for a re-election. Some members of your own party would like to see a more forceful challenge to Baker. What's your view on this?
So I think we will continue to have disagreements, but we will do so without being disagreeable. The governor and I have had a conversation about this. I said, look, we have two hats. We have the hat which we wear at least 9 to 5 every day, which is when we're doing policy and governing. And then we have the hat that we have to put on during the election year, where on the evenings and the weekends we're going to be out there campaigning. We need to be able to differentiate and separate what we do and recognize that when we're working in this building, we're working together to find common ground, build solutions that will help the people of the Commonwealth. And it isn't about partisanship. It's about getting the best result. When we go on the campaign trail, of course, we're going to be loyal to our parties and to our party's ideas. And we may even say a few things here and there that might sting a little, but that's on the political side of it. As long as overall we recognize and remember we're here to work together to serve the people, we're going to be able to have another good term as we did this past.
All right. Well, that's Massachusetts Senate President Stan Rosenberg, a Democrat from Amherst. Mr. Senate President, thanks again for joining us, and congratulations on your reelection today. And
thank you so much.
And Happy New Year.
Look forward to being with you again in the future.
Well,
Take care.
We always enjoy having you. Thank you, sir. And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.